Thanks for the introduction and invitation. It's a pleasure to be at the Perimeter Institute. So I come from the realm of probability. So let me just start by stating my broad goal, which is to, so my broad goal here is to introduce and analyze stochastic, typically discrete systems, and show that they converge, you know, introduce and analyze the ones that converge to something interesting on the continuum. Although my main goal here is not to analyze the continuum object, but to understand how the discrete converges to it. So in this context, a useful tool for analysis, which is one that the audience almost certainly knows well here, is the Yang-Baxter equation. So maybe, if nothing else, to just set some notation. It takes the form, or solutions to the Yang-Baxter equation, maybe is what I should be saying. So it takes the form R12 of U1 over U2 times R13 of U1 over U3 times R23 of U2 over U3 is equal to another R. So these R matrices are these three R matrices are elements of some endomorphism ring of the tensor product of these three vector spaces. So I fix some vector spaces v1, v2, and v3, and then these Rij's live in this tensor product, this endomorphism of the tensor product between them, and they act as the identity on any vk for k not in Rij. These U's are known as spectral parameters. You can just view them as simply parameters associated with these R's, and solutions to this equation are useful for analyzing discrete vertex models. So in general, solutions to the Yang-Baxter equation give rise to integrable vertex models, or exactly solvable. But remember, my goal here as a probabilist is to analyze stochastic models. So when is this solution going to be stochastic? So the model is stochastic, or Markovian, if and only if the solution, this R matrix here, is rho stochastic. So what that means is that the sum of the entries in each row is one, right? So this is what it means to be a Markov matrix. You have to have the sum of the entries in each row to be one. If I happen to have a solution to the Yang-Baxter equation satisfying this property, then that gives me a stochastic integrable system, or a Markov system that I can try to analyze using methods of exact solvability. But if I don't, then I have to do something. I mean, then it's not totally clear that I get a Markov chain out of it. And the unfortunate feature is that this is typically not satisfied. So one of the things I want to explain in this talk is this notion of stochasticization. So this is taking a solution. This takes possibly non-stochastic solution of the Yang-Baxter equation and produces systematically, sort of in a systematic way, produces a stochastic one. Okay, so I plan to explain more about the stochasticization procedure later in the talk, but let me first try to describe reasons why one might care. So one might want to do something along these lines. So okay. Okay, so reasons, I guess. Okay, so first is sort of the one that was implied by this spiel, which is that it produces many families. Of integrable Markov chains. But my eventual goal here is asymptotic analysis, being able to say something on the thermodynamical limit. And just because your Markov chain is integrable or exactly solvable doesn't mean you actually have, I mean, there are plenty of integrable models in statistical mechanics where we can't rigorously or mathematically say anything about the thermodynamical limiting behavior. So in principle, I should want to be able to say something asymptotic about these Markov chains. And the second is that, so this is reason one. So reason two is that the algebraic analysis of the stochastic models that come out of this procedure is sometimes, in many cases, it can be easier than that of non-stochastic models. So I won't go too much into this today, but I mean just like the half-line explanation for why this is the case is that the Betti equations, which are mathematically difficult to get any sort of traction on, are somehow no longer present for these stochastic models. Essentially, what happens is that the Betti equations you can view as coming from solving some solving some Bedi-Ansatz with certain boundary conditions, but the boundary conditions somehow some periodic boundary conditions, but the periodicity of the boundary conditions is lost when you take is no longer necessary to impose in a certain sense when you impose the stochasticity of the model. So this makes the Betti equations no longer present, which makes the algebraic analysis of these stochastic models easier to analyze. And this can lead to very refined asymptotic results. Okay, so the third reason, another point on the ability to analyze these models is that certain aspects of the integrability of these models can be interpreted probabilistically. So in particular, I mean, you can get, so for example, you can get stochastic couplings, deformations of the R matrix give rise to stochastic couplings, which allow you to couple two versions of this model, which is a useful technique in probability. And there are some others that I won't mention. And this can lead, these models can be studied using methods of probability. And I guess the last point is that that I'll try to say just a few words on here, is that the results, if you don't care about stochastic models, then the results about these stochastic models sometimes translate to results about non-stochastic ones, about sort of the original model, the one that you got before stochasticizing it. Okay, so before, the basic outline of the talk is that I'll try to explain a few examples of these, of results. I'll just give you a series of results without proofs that sort of indicate or give instances of each of the four, or at least maybe the, at least the first three of the points listed there, which will hopefully convince you that there is some interesting physical phenomenology behind these stochastic models. And then I'll try to explain a little bit more about this stochasticization procedure that creates stochastic solutions of the Young-Baxter equation from non-stochastic ones. So I'll give a few examples of these, the models, the stochastic models and results you can prove about them. Okay, so I'll start with the six vertex model. So we have some, this might be familiar to many people in the room, but I guess just again for the sake of fixing notation, I have some domain in Z2, which technically the cylinder and the torus are not in Z2, but I'll allow them. And you assign each vertex in your domain an arrow configuration or a state, which satisfies the so-called ICE rule. So you need for the number, so at each vertex you have some arrows coming in and some arrows coming out, and this ICE rule is that the number of arrows coming in has to equal the number of arrows coming out. Okay, so these have weights, which I'll call W of V. And this has weight A1, A2, B1, B2, C1, C2. So these are parameters I associate with my model, and then I have those weights associated with it. Okay, and then the weight of a the weight of some configuration is simply the product of the weights of the vertices. So, for example, I mean, this has weight, what? So I have C2, A1, A2, and C2 squared, I guess. Okay. And, right, and then you have a probability measure. Where the probability of a certain configuration is proportional to its weight. Okay, so this is reasonably basic and standard. So the stochastic six vertex model is the object I want to first talk about. Okay, so the weights of this model are, let me write them over here. So the weights of this model are going to be specific. So they're 1, 1, B1, B2, and 1 minus B1, 1 minus B2. So I've cuffed B1 and B2 over here, but I've fixed A1 and A2 to be 1, and I fixed C1 and C2 to be 1 minus B1 and 1 minus B2 respectively. In the quantum group or spectral parameter worlds, these are typically parametrized in terms of a Q and a Z. So I'll just write them down. And this Q, this Q is equal to B1 over B2. It lies in, we'll always assume it lies in 0, 1, and this is sometimes known as a quantization parameter. And the Z, which is the quotient of these two guys, so 1 minus, 1 minus B2 over 1 minus B1. is known as a spectral parameter. And the associated R matrix comes from two-dimensional representations of U Q SL2 hat, and this Q is the same Q as this Q. Okay. So, all right, fine. So, right. So the reason for the the reason for this choice of weights is that this makes the model stochastic. So conditional. So the stochasticity property is conditional on the number of arrows on the incoming arrows, the sum of the weights of the outgoing arrows of all possible configurations with those incoming arrows is one. So okay, let me explain what I mean by that. So there are four possibilities for how arrows can come in, right? They can either both two arrows can come in, no arrows can come in, one can come in vertically, or one can come in horizontally. So as you can see, if I take two coming in, the sum of those is just one. None coming in, the sum is one. If I just have one arrow coming in from the vertical, then there are these two possibilities, but they're something to one. And likewise here, if I restrict to those configurations in which one vertical arrow comes in, so this is attached to this model. So if I restrict to the configurations in which one horizontal arrow comes in, which are these two, they also sum to one. Okay, and this is the stochasticity property, and this allows a local Markovian sampling procedure of this model. So that looks as follows. So let's suppose I have certain boundary conditions for my model. Okay. So at each point, I flip a coin. I see which incoming, what are the arrows incoming. I look at my vertices here with the same incoming configuration. So I start here, for example. I see one arrow incoming horizontally. The only two of the six vertices with that possibility is this one and this one. I flip a coin with probability B2. If it hits heads, I flip a coin that has a B2 bias. And if it comes, say, heads, then it goes. Then this arrow keeps on going forward. If it comes tails, then the arrow goes up. So let's say it hits tails, so the arrow goes up. Okay. Then the next vertex is this one, and I now look at the two configurations that have one vertical arrow coming in. So there are these two, and I once again flip a coin, but now with weight B2. Let's say it comes out tails this time. This arrow goes forward, and likewise, I can keep on. Okay, so now this one is a little bit different. This one, I have two arrows coming in, and there's only one possible configuration that has weight 1. So if you like, I flip a coin that comes with heads probability 1 and tails with probability 0. So I iterate this process. So at each vertex, I have some sort of local rule. I have some sort of local coin flip that tells me how I should be propagating the arrows at that vertex, and then I iterate. And let's say I get something like this. Okay, so this gives rise to a stochastic model in the sense that at each vertex there's some like local coin flip I can do that runs the vertices in the system. Okay. Okay, good. Okay, so is this too far to one side or no? This is good. Okay.
Does it matter which order you choose to flip the
vertices? Well, no. I have to go from left to right. It does not commute. I can also do them sort of diagonal. I can go in this direction, like do this, and that will be the same. Yeah. Okay. I eventually want to analyze the asymptotics of this model. So it'll be convenient for me to talk about height functions of this model. So I'm going to assign it to each face f of lambda, we assign HF, which is some real number, and it satisfies So the following local constraints. So there are, a vertical edge can either be occupied or unoccupied, which I'll draw by dashed, by an arrow. And likewise, a horizontal edge can either be occupied or unoccupied by an arrow. So the rule is that I decrease by one every time I pass a vertical edge from the left. I decrease from one by one every time I pass a vertical edge from the bottom, and the opposite. So I increase by one every time I do not cross. I cross the absence of an edge, if you wish, from the left, and likewise I increase by one here. So given a vertex given a six vertex model, given like an ensemble So given some six vertex configuration, and given some reference height, so say I fix, the height function to be zero over here, I can use these rules to propagate the height function everywhere else in the domain. So for example, I'm passing to fill in the height value here, I use this rule. So the bottom is always less one less than the top if I'm going across an arrow. So if I go across an arrow this way, it should decrease by one. And if I go down, it should increase by one because I'm crossing the absence of an edge. And then I can keep going and fill everything in this way. Okay, so this is how the height function looks. And then if I have a larger domain, I would similarly, by local rules, just fill my function for the rest of the domain. Okay, so the arrow, this arrow conservation, tells me that, in terms of this height function, this tells me that h of f minus h of f prime equals one if f is adjacent to f prime, meaning that they share an edge. So I can view this. Right, so I can view this. I guess I'll start over here. So as I say, I'm viewing this. I have a height function associated with the six vertex model. And I can view this height function as sort of producing some sort of discrete surface, a discrete random surface, where the height of the surface is just the value of the height function. So you can view this stochastic six vertex model as sort of a Markovian way of growing a random surface, or a Markovian formation of a random surface. So this is this is totally analogous to a simple random walk. So it's like a higher dimensional analog of a simple random walk. In the sense that a random walk, it also has this Lipschitz property, right? I mean, I start from zero and then I add one and subtract one. That satisfies the Lipschitz property. This is more or less doing the exact same thing, except I'm going in multiple directions and I'm just imposing the Lipschitz property along any four bonds. So, along any vertical or horizontal edge. So this is more or less some variant of higher dimensional variant of the simple random walk. And my goal is just to analyze the asymptotes. So my interests are in the law of large numbers, which I'll typically call a limit shape, and fluctuations for this height function, for h, where h is sampled according to this stochastic six vertex model. Okay, so I'll start by, so as I said, I wanted to give some examples of the results that happen across along these reasons that I just erased. So I'll start by explaining a limit shape phenomenon. So I consider the stochastic six vertex model on a cylinder. So that cylinder is looking like Z mod NZ times, say, 0, 1, 2, all the way to N. So cylinder, and this height here is N, and the circumference is also N. Okay, I define this phi of x. So this is some function. I mean, the exact form of it is not really relevant, but I'll just write it down for completeness. Okay, and this z is this z. So it's 1 minus b2 or 1 minus b1. So if I define phi in this way, then I can get some good characterization on how, if I like say take a six vertex model with some boundary conditions on the base, and I run the stochastic six vertex model, I can get a law of large numbers for the limit shape of the model. And that's the following. So before I say that, I need to tell you what the boundary conditions are. So so the boundary conditions so you fix some one Lipschitz function psi from S1 to R. And then I assume, so I have some boundary data, right? And the boundary data corresponds to some height function. So I assume that the boundary conditions, which correspond to the height function, whose y-coordinate is 0. So these are, I mean, so yeah, right? So this is on the boundary. This is on the bottom face of the cylinder. And I assume that this converges to psi of x. So this gives me the boundary conditions for the six vertex model on the bottom end of the cylinder. And the theorem. OK, so is the following. So this n, so if I'm looking, so this gives me the initial data. So then I should run it. So I look at some point nx, ny. And the statement is that this will converge to g of xy, where, okay, so where the initial conditions of g are the ones you would guess from this, just g of xy is equal to psi of x. And how do I determine from the initial data? Well, okay, so I define g, little g, to be the derivative in the x direction of capital G, and then this satisfies the following equation. Okay, so this phi is this phi, and then this is the equation. Okay, so this is sort of a PDE limit for this is sometimes known as a one conservation law. So you run the stochastic six vertex model with this initial data. I analyze how the height function looks, and then it will look like the solution to a certain SD, a certain PDE with this initial data, and this is the exact PDE.
Doesn't this depend on Q?
Yes. Well, it's so it. So remarkably, it. You're saying that there's no Q here. So if I remember correctly, it actually doesn't, which is pretty interesting. Yeah. No. It only depends on the quotient. So Q is the quotient of B1 and B2, and Z is the quotient of 1 minus B1 and 1 minus B2. And remarkably enough, the PDE, at least the dynamics of the PDE, do not depend on Q, but only on the quotient of those two.
I think the lack of symmetry between X and Y very bizarre.
Lack of symmetry. Well, I mean, It's already in the model, right? Because why is the direction? I mean, why is I'm viewing y as, I mean, so I'm looking on a cylinder, right? So that automatically imposes some H symmetry between the x, the vertical and horizontal. If you like, you can view it on a quadrant.
Yes.
And then you they will still satisfy the same PDE. And this PDE can also this PDE can also be interpreted in terms of, I can also write a different PDE. And there's some different phi.
And different G because I should take.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. The true mysteriously.
They're the same. Is
phi tilde less similar to phi, or?
Maybe it's the functional inverse. Although I don't quote me on that. I'm not entirely sure, but it might just be the functional inverse of phi. Yeah, they're closely related. Yeah.
It's really strange. The first equation has only one y derivative.
Exchange b1 and b2, right? I mean, doesn't that exchange x?
Not quite. There's a distribution of some equivalent.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they're both first order in x and y. So.
No, but the equation for the underlying function g, right?
Capital G.
The equation for the function capital G.
Yeah. Right.
They don't look like the same equation for the capital G.
Well, no, these are functions for derivatives of G, right? This is, I see what you mean. Yeah, no. It's not totally obvious just by looking at it. Yeah.
It's really not obvious.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not even. There's an equation with of higher degree that somehow can be integrated in different ways.
Well, you can, okay, so something that you can solve this equation through the method of characteristics. And what that will basically do is if you, right, so there are these characteristic lines.
No, sorry, I'm silly. If I integrate the first equation, I could integrate over y, over x, right?
Yes.
And then you can see the y of capital G equal to function of dx capital G. And then clearly.
Yeah, right. So you integrate the side with respect to x, and you get this as a g here, right? This is what you're saying. Yes. And then you get a phi of
that's
partial
right,
x of g. And then they look much more similar. Right.
And the other same. Yes.
Yeah. Right.
But why didn't you write the equation for capital G then?
Sorry?
Why do you write this equation which has a bit
derivative? Well, it's a little bit more intuitive to me to look at them in terms of. I mean, the way I think of it is that this little g here gives me the density of states along the horizontal line. So this is giving me an evolution equation for the density of states, which is how I kind of, that's a relevant point for actually proving this theorem, is that you want to look at the density of states and see how it evolves over time.
When I integrate over x, I'm going to get an integration constant, which is an arbitrary function of y. Right.
Sorry?
So if I take this equation and I integrate by x.
Yeah.
I get an equation as an arbitrary function of y.
Yeah, in principle, yeah.
And only if the function is zero, it's equivalent to the bottom equation.
Right.
So should I always take the function to be zero, or?
You mean the, the integration constant is, wait.
Perhaps I can find sorry to.
No, I think I see what you're saying, but you're going to get a it should vanish, yeah. I think
it's an arbitrary function of y inside, so it seems to be if you say that the function is zero, then this equation is weaker than the one you.
No, the one I'm after. Okay, I mean, well, okay, right. So in. Give me a second.
I guess giving these two equations is probably equivalent to giving the. Integrated
equation. Yeah. Okay. Fine. Yeah.
You're right. The two derivatives of the.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Fine. So if you want, I should be giving both of them. It might just be that I'm supposed to be adding zero. Well. Yeah, okay. Okay, yeah, right. Yeah. If you want, just take them both. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. So I mean, yeah, they'll both determine determine G, right? So, okay. So these are the limit shape. This is the limit shape result. If you want fluctuations, I can. These are harder to get, as you might expect. So I will restrict to a certain type of boundary conditions. And these boundary conditions are going to be the following. So I'll have arrows enter from the bottom, and I'll have arrows enter from, I'll be looking at this model in a quadrant now rather than a cylinder. And they'll come out of the x-axis with some probability rho, and they're all going to be independent, so completely uncorrelated. And then on the y-axis, they're going to come out with some probability lambda, and they're also going to be independent. And the x, the rho and the lambda are going to be, I mean, the arrows entering from exiting from the x-axis and from the y-axis are going to be mutually independent from each other. And what I'll assume is that, so rho is in 0, 1, of course, and then lambda is going to be a certain function of rho, which I'll call f of rho. And this f is going to be given by rho over 1 minus z of rho. Plus z. So it's the same z. Right. So yeah. So then right. Okay. So then the statement is the following. So I'm gonna assume that lambda is of this specific form. You can also get fluctuation results when lambda is different from the specific value of f of rho, but the results I'm going to describe are going to be different in those cases. So the most interesting, in my opinion, result is when these parameters are tuned in a specific way, and you get some interesting behavior. So theorem is the following. Okay, right, so the theorem. Oops, no, is the following. So, okay, so I'm going to set just by force, so just set it, just fix the height function here to be 0. Okay, and then, okay, so then I look at h of some points xn, yn. And I subtract the expectation. Okay, and then this will have two different behaviors. So as n tends to infinity, this will have two different behaviors. So in the first case, it will tend to the scaling of this thing, the order of magnitude of these fluctuations will be n to the 1/2, and you'll get a Gaussian. So this is. In the second case, you're going to see an n to the 1/3 as the exponent, as the order of fluctuations, and you're going to see a different random variable appearing here, and this is known as the Bike-Rains distribution. I won't define it, but it's a non-Gaussian probability distribution. Okay, so when do each of these occur? This one occurs if x over y is not equal to. Is not equal to the derivative of f. So f is, remember this guy. So if x over y is not the derivative of f at rho, then it's going to be Gaussian with this n to the 1/2 order fluctuations. And otherwise, if x over y is exactly given by this value, by this point, then it's going to be n to the 1/3 fluctuations, then you're going to see the Bike-Rains distribution. So the picture I have in mind is that there is this sort of characteristic line, x is equal to f prime rho. And then on this line, you see the bike, the n to the 1/3, and then Bike-Rains distribution, and then everywhere else you see n to the 1/2 in Gaussian. Yeah. So right. So that's the fluctuation statement. So interestingly enough, it's not rotationally invariant. There is this sort of anisotropy along this single characteristic line, and then elsewhere and then off that characteristic line, it behaves just Gaussian. There's a version of the statement for correlation functions. So if I let sigma of u be the indicator for a vertical arrow exiting vertex u, then the consequence of this result is that the covariance between sigma u and sigma v for any vertices, say u and v, you might ask about the decay of these guys as u minus v tends to infinity. So let u minus, I'll let the distance be r. So there are two possibilities. So it's gonna decay like r to the minus 2/3 or exponentially. And this is again if u minus v is on this vector, I'll call this vector w. And then if otherwise it's exponential decay. So what this is saying is that if the difference vector between u and v is on that specific characteristic line with the slope, the correlations decay like a power law. But off of that line, if this vector is pointing in any other direction, it decays exponentially. Okay, so this is right. Okay, so these are all for the six vertex model. Before proceeding with the sort of stochasticization method, I want to quickly describe another model, which is called a dynamical model. So the stochastic six vertex model, the six vertex model, is associated with representations of UQSL2. So the model I'll explain a little bit about next is a stochastic interface model associated with the elliptic quantum group E(8SL2). So it's a remarkably simple looking model, but it's a bit strange. It's also non-Gaussian though. So the model, I'll describe one. This model is not due to me, but it's closely it's in the vein of things that are of interest in this direction. So I start with some function. So the states will be some function s of t, which will map z, which map the integers to the non-negative integers, and we'll view it as evolving in t. Okay, so the initial data is s0 of x is equal to the absolute value of x. So I have this function here, and it starts out looking like a corner. Okay, right, so it looks like that. Okay, and then we'll always impose the restriction, or the Lipschitz condition, more or less. The restriction is always going to be that s of t of x minus s of t of x minus 1 is equal to 1. So it always has to look like a broken line of slope 1 or minus 1. Okay. So then the dynamics are the following. So as you can see, based on this picture, there are four possibilities for how two adjacent vertices can be connected. They can either be connected looking like this, looking like this, or looking like this. Okay. So I'm going to imagine sort of the middle vertex doing something is what the dynamics are going to be doing. So if the picture locally looks like this, then the middle vertex can't move, right? If it tries to move up, then this line would violate the Lipschitz condition. If it tries to move down, then the Lipschitz condition would be violated here. So this is sort of a frozen, these two conditions are frozen. If the model is in this state, then this vertex cannot move at all. However, if the model is in this state, but what I will allow is for the model to go back and forth between, locally go back and forth between these two states. Namely, corners can sort of flip up at random. Okay. So.
Crystal melting.
Huh? Crystal's melting, yeah, but it can also freeze again.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so as I said, it can go from here to here, or from here to here. Okay, so this is x minus 1, this is x plus 1. Okay, so so this is going to happen randomly, and at rate. So it's going to flip down at some rate dt of x, and it's going to flip up at rate ut of x. And I have to tell you what d and t are.
Is x dependent?
Huh?
Is x dependent?
Correct. Correct. Yeah. That is the model. That's the x. Let me write down the weights, and I'll explain sort of algebraically the algebraic origin behind it very quickly. So dt of x is going to be 1 plus 1 over st of x. And ut of x is going to be 1 minus 1 over st of x plus 2. Okay. It's a little bit, okay. So so as you can see, the rates depend on the value, on the height of the vertex of the corner before the flip. And this is sort of corresponding to, in the elliptic quantum groove, you have some dynamical parameter, which is very closely related to the height function I had drawn over there. So the rates are dependent on this dynamical parameter. So, right. So the height function, it has a slight preference to go down because d is bigger than u. But as it go higher and higher up, this dependence is less and less. So it's a crystal that wants to freeze more than it wants to melt. But it cares less and less as it melts more, you can say. So, okay, right, so the theorem, which is due to Borden in 2017, is that, okay, so t to the minus, so I'm interested in how these, all right, let me write it down first, then I'll say. Okay, so I'm interested in the large scale behavior of S of t of ty. So I'm scaling y with t, and then I want to take time to be large. So the first claim is that this is x, this order of magnitude is t to the 1/4. Okay, t to the 1/4. And then this is going to converge as t tends to infinity to the square root of z plus 1. And now the z is a random variable. With the following probability distributions. The probability that z is equal to x is, I'll just give you the density function. So it's it's an exponential distribution, more or less. So it's the square root of an exponential distribution plus 1, where the constant, the parameter of all the exponential, is dependent on y in some way. So another non-Gaussian fluctuations. This model, as I said before, comes from a vertex model. I made time continuous here, but it actually comes from a vertex model associated with a dynamical R matrix. From a two-dimensional representation of the elliptic quantum group, so this e tau eta sl 2, and you've actually so this. The Young-Baxter equation for these elliptic quantum groups, they have a dynamical parameter involved in them. And that dynamical parameter is more or less this S. So what you're kind of doing is you're asking how the dynamical parameter evolves in the model. And the dependence of the rates on S are sort of indicating the dependence of the entries of the R matrix on the dynamical parameter, basically. So you've actually here, you might ask, what are tau and eta? What do they have to do with the rates of this model? So you've actually taken this model actually comes from taking tau to I infinity and eta to zero. So taking tau to I infinity corresponds to the trigonometric degeneration. And taking eta to zero corresponds to taking the rational degeneration. But you've taken the scaling in such a way that the dynamical parameter still lives. So yeah. Okay, and then I should say, you might ask what happens when you try to take there are other examples of models coming from this elliptic quantum group, and you can come up with a similar growth model. Associated with higher spin, with higher spin or higher dimensional representations, of e tau of this quantum group, of this elliptic quantum group, and remarkable about how the same similar asymptotics. So I won't tell you what this model is exactly, but it will have the similar asymptotics. Namely, this 1/4 exponent will also appear in this model, and you'll also see the square root to something involving an exponential distribution. So So I've went through this sort of lengthy discussion to try to convince you that these stochastic models, have some sorts of interesting asymptotics that can be analyzed rigorously, ranging from non-Gaussian behavior to non-trivial limit shapes to strong anisotropy. And so I guess hopefully I've justified my desire to find more examples of integrable stochastic systems. And this is where, so then I want to spend, I guess, I have to stop at 3.
Yeah, we have
room to
3, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it's fine to go to
3
if you want.
Or I can stop before. when one is typical? I just looked at this.
I mean, I think usually we sort of, you know, take a break around 2:30 so that people need to go, they can, but... you know, it's not a very strict thing.
That's fine. Okay.
And then keep going.
Yeah.
That's fine. Yeah, we can take a break now. Yeah, and then I'll talk about the stochasticization for another half hour, basically. Yeah. So then I'll stop. Yeah.
Obviously,
a more
informal discussion.
Yeah. Sure.
Sorry.
That makes sense. Yeah, I'm totally happy to take a break. It's good for me too.
Or if you want to get a
break
or something.
I'm good. Let me know when you should resume.
Whenever you're ready.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Oh, you're right. Okay. Cool. Okay, so yeah, now I want to talk about how to stochasticize this part is joint work with Alexei Borden and Alexei Bifedov last year. 2 years ago. So yeah, again, so my goal here is to take a solution to the Young-Baxter equation and produce a stochastic one. Okay, so it requires several inputs, several pieces of data. So first is an R matrix, whose entries I'll call W. And this is what I want to stochasticize. This is the thing that I'm going to want to stochasticize. Okay. So, and then we'll assume that this R matrix satisfies the Young-Baxter equation. So satisfies the RRR equals RR version of the Young-Baxter equation. Okay. The second point that I'll need is for I'll need a T matrix with entries chi. With respect to which I will stochasticize W. So I'll sort of I'll use chi to twist W into something stochastic. And this T matrix will satisfy the relation. So we'll have this RTT plus TTR relation. Okay. And the third point is, which I will discuss later, is some notion of a frozen vertices. I'll discuss that in a little bit more detail. So rather than try to explain to you how this works in the abstract, I'll just take an example and run the stochasticization procedure on that example. And that should explain to you, I hope that will give you some indication of what to do in general and the sorts of things that come out of this procedure. So everything will be totally explicit. I'll give you the weights and everything. I mean, I'll give you the whole, everything in this baby example I'll give you are going to be totally explicit. And the one thing you might complain about is that this example that I'm going to describe to you is it's already going to be stochastic. So the stochasticization procedure will give out, in one scenario, it will act as the identity. It's not going to do anything. But it's actually going to give more than give you the stochastic thing back. It's going to give you more stochastic examples. So already, even if I start out with a stochastic object, it will give me more examples of stochastic things satisfying the Young-Baxter equation. So hopefully this is not going to be totally worthless if I explain the example to you that's already stochastic. So it's pretty useful because everything again will be totally explicit. If I try to go an example that's not stochastic to start out with, then the formulas are going to get much more messy, and then it might be harder to see what's going on. So I need to give you the W and the T to start. These W's and the chi's to start out with, and these W's will be vertex weights. For the stochastic six vertex model, the one I had over there. So these are going to be vertex weights. For a vertex of the following form. So I'm going to have I1 is always going to be the number of vertical arrows coming in. J1 is going to be the number of horizontal arrows coming in. And then similarly coming out. So this x, these will depend on some parameters x and y. So x is a row spectral parameter, and y is a column parameter. So these are spectral parameters. So I'll just write down what the weights are, I guess. So you have 1, 1, q times x minus y over x minus qy, x minus y over x minus qy, and then 1 minus q times x over x minus qy, and 1 minus q times y over x minus qy. So these are the weights of the 6-vertex model. I think you can get the previous ones I'd written down by just assuming x equals 1 or something like that. And those will give you the previous weights I'd written. Right, so now those are the W weights. Okay, so these are the W weights. Okay, now I have to tell you what the chi weights are. So chi is going to be infinite spin in the vertical direction, but spin 1/2 in the horizontal direction. So so the chi weights are going to be as follows. So I fix some parameter, so maybe complex parameter S, and then.
So when you say infinite spin, is it in a Verma module?
Huh?
Does it live in a Verma module?
You're right. Yeah, it's like a fused Verma module or analytically continued. Fusion parameter, if you want. But yeah, it lives in a Verma module. Yeah. Okay, so there are four general types of possibilities. So depending on how many arrows come in and how many arrows come out. So I have the first is where no arrows come in and no arrows come out. The second one is one arrow comes in and none come out. Okay, so. And I'm always going to be assuming I have some number of arrows coming in, which might be 0. I'll denote the number of arrows coming in always by k. And then the number of arrows coming out is forced by the arrow conservation. OK, so this is how it looks. And then the weights of these guys are, again, that's. I'm not going to do anything too fancy with these weights. I just want to convince you that they're reasonably explicit.
So are these weights like literally the only matrix for a Verma module?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, exactly. Yeah, you can view them as coming from fusion of these weights from the Kulesh Glaunov-Rushdie confusion of these weights, or you can view them as coming from a Verma module of UKSL2 hat. Yeah. So again, this x I view as attached to the row, and y I view as attached to the vertical. Okay. So So the Young-Baxter equation. Now the RTT. So there are two versions of it. There's the RRR equals RRR, and these are going to be for the W weights, and then the W and the chi weights going to have an RTT. RTT equals TTR. Okay. So I'll just. In order to maybe make things a little bit easier, I'll draw these in different colors. So I'll draw the vertex in different colors. So I'll draw this vertex in green. So the chi vertices are always going to be in green. And then the white vertices I'll draw in white, I guess. Okay, so this one's one that you. Okay, all right, so. So this one's so you can visually represent them like this, where this this green line is sort of the so these are the two T's and this is the R, and these are the two T's and this is the R. Okay. So then I'm going to so now let me try to explain how this will work. So I've given you the W's, I've given you the chi's, and now what do I mean by the frozen vertices? So what that means is that if I fix a certain output, then that forces the input. So the frozen vertices. So I need frozen vertices for W. So I should have said over here, these are frozen vertices for W. And what does that mean? That means that if I fix, there is a certain output so that the input is forced in order for the weight to be non-zero. So the output, so the claim here is that if I2, J2 is 0, 0, then W, I1, J1, I2, J2 equals 0 unless I1, J1 equals 0, 0. Okay, so this is somewhat obvious from the definition of the model. It's a reasonable generic fact. So, so this means that no arrows are coming out here. And if no arrows come out, then no arrows are allowed to come in. Okay, and then I'll draw these sorts of frozen vertices with squares. Okay, so now let me try to explain how this, okay, so now I've given you all three ingredients. Now let me try to explain to you how the stochasticization procedure works. So let me try to derive. So we have the RTT equals TTR relation. So what that tells me is that, so here I'm, let me draw this a little bit bigger. Okay, so I have I1, J1, say K1. I have J2, I2, J3, I3, K3, 2, and then I'm summing over the middle guys. So, and then some of these are supposed to be green, right? Okay. So, right. Okay, these are. Okay, this is how it looks so far. So, so I have these weights, and what in principle I want to do is I want to do something to them to make them sum to one. Okay, the problem is that they sum to some messy sum on the right side. So what I'll do is the first thing I'll try to do is I'm going to freeze the right-hand side using my frozen vertex so that the sum is only supported by one element. So the first thing you do is you choose I3 and J3 to be frozen, okay? So that in practice, that what that corresponds to is making them both zero. Okay, and that of course fixes K3 by the arrow conservation, and then what happens is the sum disappears. And there's only one allowable configuration on the right-hand side. Okay, good. So now we're going to do something kind of silly. So if I divide this by this, then I get something that sums to one, right? And I can also, I don't also have to sum over I2, J2, and K2. I can only sum over I2 and J2 because K2 is then forced the moment I fixed I2 and J2. So oh, sorry. Now this is going to be a frozen vertex, so it's what I had drawn by this square. And then I divide by. So then these are empty. Okay, and then I have here I1, J1, J2, I2, and then K1, K2, K3. So, and then here it's K1, I1, J1. And then since zero arrows come in, since zero arrows exit, that means zero arrows are allowed to come in. And this fixes the two values of K over here to be K1 plus I1 and K1 plus I1 plus J1. Okay. So again, I've forced the I's, the outgoing I's and J's to be zero. So this is what I've done so far. Okay, now, but then by definition, this sums to one. So, I'll define now, I'll just define we'll define this stochastic weight to be given by that quotient. And there will be a problem with doing that, but let me just do that for the moment. So I define S, X, Y. So here I should say that there are spectral parameters involved, right? So along the X direction, I have the spectral along the horizontal, along the J, say the J line, I have some spectral parameter X. Along the Y line, I have some spectral parameter Y. Along the Z line, I have some spectral parameter S, some Z. And then there's this parameter S associated with the Verman module, which is Z. So these weights in principle depend on X, Y, Z, and S. And they also depend on this incoming guy, K, because I've fixed some number of arrows coming in this green line. Okay? And by definition, I'm just setting it to be the quotient that I see in that sum over there, which is so then I have J1, I1, K1, and then I1, J1, K1. Okay, and then these are the two. And then just to remind you, the X's are along the J's, the Y's are along the I's. And the Z's and the S's are along the case. Okay, so so this is just definition. And the Yang-Baxter equation, the TTR equals RTT version of the Yang-Baxter equation, tells you that they sum to one. Okay. Now, given these weights, given those vertex weights, I can explicitly write down what they are. So I'll just write down, maybe I'll just write down two of them. So I mean, I can write down this is going to give me a W. So yeah, maybe I'll write down what this quotient looks like first, and then I'll only write down two examples of the weights. I just want to show you what this thing looks like in comparison to the original weights. So I have this W of X, Y, I1, J1, I2, J2 coming from here. Then I have this chi, so this is a J2. So then I have chi of XZ, I guess, of K1, J2, K2, J3. And then I have another chi of YZ of K2, I2, K3. I3. Okay, and then I have to divide by something. So I divide by, on the bottom, this frozen vertex is going to give me 0, 0, 0, 0. And then I have some more chi's coming in from here. And I won't write them down, but one can compute them. Okay, so at the end of the day, it's simply a gauge transformation of the original weights W. Okay, so so as an example, from the original weights, these new stochasticized weights will look like Q X minus. So if I say to take the vertical weight, and maybe I'll take the vertical weight and this corner weight here. So this is going to be 1 minus QX, 1 minus QVY over X minus QY, and then 1 minus QVX. Now what is V? V is this Z, S, Z, and K all combined to form V. So this V here is going to be S Q to the K 1 over Z. Okay. So this is just an example. So you can quickly see that these sum to 1, and that if v is 0, these just reduce the original weights. These are simple gauge transformations of the original weights. But now I have an extra parameter v in the game. So I might ask now, do these weights satisfy, do these S weights satisfy the Young-Baxter equation? So SSS equals the SSS. This version of the Young-Baxter equation. Now the thing is, you have this additional parameter. K or maybe V just by this transformation that is associated with each that can be associated with each vertex, right? I haven't told you how to pick this K once. In principle, this V that you're attaching to each stochasticized vertex in principle it could be free, it could be different at each vertex. So I mean, a priori, you might just imagine, OK, I just make all of the k's equal, and then you can hope for the Young-Baxter equation to hold. But that's not going to be right. So if I make all of the k's equal at each vertex, the Young-Baxter equation will not hold. So what you need to make this Young-Baxter equation hold is you need for this s parameter, you need for this v parameter to be, so this relationship will hold if this k is a dynamic, acts as a dynamical parameter. So it changes from vertex to vertex according to certain local rules, much like that height function I had written on the previous board, changed from vertex to vertex according to certain rules. Now, in order for this to be reasonably systematic, I have to tell you how to easily determine these rules, okay? And that's done by, so what I did here was basically I took my chi line and I put it next to a vertex and I moved the chi line through that vertex. So if I want to make the Young-Baxter equation hold, what I can hope to do is I can take my chi line next to a Young-Baxter equation, and then move that chi line through the Young-Baxter equation itself. Okay, so I'll draw what that looks like pictorially. Okay, so I have my Young-Baxter equation for R. So it looks like this, so I have maybe I1 here, J1 here, and K1 here. And then I have, I have that this is equal to the corresponding Young-Baxter equation for, so I pull this through here, and what I'll get is I1, K1. J1. Okay. So this is the Young-Baxter equation for R. And now I'll do what I did before, namely I'll attach this. Oh, sorry, I'll make this an H instead of a K. And then I'll put in my new sort of my chi line through here. And then I'll also put it in the chi line here. So. Okay, and what the stochasticization procedure was doing was it was moving this chi line through each vertex and saying that the weight of the new vertex is sort of the quotient of what I had before I moved the chi line through the vertex and what I had after I moved the chi line through the vertex. Okay, but now I have this parameter k that I have to. Okay, so this k is attached to the chi line, and I have to say how to actually assign it to each vertex. Okay, so remember this in the stochasticization procedure. I made these vertices. I made nothing come out of these chi lines. They were sort of collectors. They collected all the vertices. So now what you're going to do is you're going to slowly move this chi line through each vertex, and that will change the value of k in a certain way. So let me try to explain that. So let me take this picture first, and I'll move the chi line through this vertex. Okay. So what you'll get is Okay, and then I take okay, so this right, and then I start with this being sorry, give me a sec. Okay.
Unnecessary crossing at the
farm. Yeah, yeah, right, right. Okay. So right, okay, let me actually do this all that different. I'm gonna take this line here and then move it below. Okay. So I don't need this. I'm gonna just take this line and move it down. So and then these were both zero. These both had nothing in them. So I'll make these dashed. And this is also dashed. This has nothing in it. Okay, so then so this one here is frozen. Okay, and then I have these. Okay. So the value of K1. Okay, so I'm trying to stochasticize this vertex in a certain sense, right? I'm trying to, these are the incoming arrows and these are the outgoing arrows. So there's a canonical choice of K1. If I fix K1 to be the number of arrows initially in this line, then the number of arrows in this line when it passes to meet this vertex is going to be, okay, so this is J2 and this is J3. It's going to be K1 plus J3, right? Because it's going to take the J3 vertices here, the J3 arrows here, and it's going to take the K1 arrows here, and then it's going to keep going with them. So it's going to be K1 plus J3 here. Okay. So this tells me the number of arrows. So if I sort of, this tells me the number of arrows in this chi line before it passes through this top vertex. So that tells me that the number of, this tells me that at this vertex here, the value of K should be K1 plus J3. So if I started with the value of K1 here, then at this, just to stochasticize this vertex, the value of K should be K1 plus K3, right? So now I've moved it through and I've divided by this quotient and then I iterate. So the next thing I have to do is I have to move this over here. Okay, so what happens when I move it through here? This is exactly the picture I had before. When I move this one through here, the stochasticization, this line, this chi line, starts out with K1 vertices. It starts out with K1 arrows. So the value of K1 to stochasticize this vertex should be so in general, what's going on is that the value of K you should be using to stochasticize any vertex is given by the number of arrows in this chi line. When I deform chi, right before I deform chi through that vertex. So here, just before I deform this chi line through this top vertex, the number of arrows in this line is K1 plus J3. Right? So then I deform it through. Next, I'm trying to stochasticize this vertex, and the number of arrows in this chi line right before I pass through this vertex is K1. Right? So then I move it through again. And the last part is to move it through this vertex. Okay. Then the number of okay, now I'm trying to stochasticize this final vertex. So the number of the value of k to stochasticize this final vertex should be okay. So first, let me draw everything, all the frozen points. So everything here is frozen, right? Because there are the boundary conditions that force these to be frozen, which forces these to be frozen. And now, since these two are frozen, that means that these two are frozen. Okay, so then the value of k right before I pass it through this vertex is going to be k1 plus h1. And then I pass it through, and then I stochasticize the final vertex. So this gives you sort of a way of, so just so the general rule is that just before I start out with some number of arrows k in this chi line, and then I pass them through one vertex at a time. And right before I pass it to the vertex, if I just look at the face, the sort of south, the southeast face of the vertex, I see how many arrows are in this chi line. That's telling me the value of k I should be choosing. So in general, there's sort of a I can write down the rule. It's relatively simple, and then I'll stop. This rule is the following. So suppose I have some arrow configuration looking like this. So I have i1, j1, j2, and i2. And let's say I have this sort of stochastic, this chi line here, and it has k arrows, right? So this is a value of k assigned to this vertex. If I want to find the value of k that should principally correspond to this vertex, it would be k plus j2. Because I imagine that, like in this situation, this chi will absorb any arrows coming out of the vertex, so it will absorb all of these j2 arrows, and therefore it will have value k plus j2 at this vertex. Likewise, I can compute the values of chi, the values of k at this vertex that would correspond to this vertex and this vertex, and they would be k plus i1 and k plus, sorry, i1 plus j1 and k plus i1. So if I sort of pass this line this way, it will absorb the i1 arrows and therefore yield k plus i1. And likewise, if I try to stochasticize this one, it would, right before it goes through, it would have k plus i1 plus j1 arrows. So this is giving you a way of assigning rules for this dynamical parameter. And you can translate this into rules for v by multiplicativity, right? So if I have v over here, that would be v to the j2 times, q to the j2 times v, and q to the i1 plus j1 times v, and then q to the i1 times v. So if I were to translate everything in terms of v's, so then I have these weights. There are four more, but I have these stochasticized weights, and they will now satisfy the Young-Baxter equation if I impose that the dynamical parameter evolve in this way. So the S weights will satisfy this Young-Baxter equation if I impose that the dynamical parameters evolve according to these rules. So if I have V over here and V over here, I have some value of V corresponding to each of these vertices, you'll have a V corresponding here, and then you'll have the number of arrows here is i2. I'll have q to the i2 times V here, following this rule. And there are likewise similar procedures I can do here, and I won't write them down, but yeah.
But these don't constrain.
Sorry?
These don't constrain the value of the S at all, or the spectral parameter of the.
That's right, yeah. These are independent. So, interestingly, you're right. So, S and Z don't really play a role in the stochasticization procedure, but that's sort of a property of the weights that you're given. You can also apply this sort of game to more general quantum groups, such as the elliptic quantum group, and there some of these parameters will have more of a role. Okay, so the fact that they sort of simplify that this dynamical parameter that everything ends up depending on, kind of collapses all of these together, is the simplifying properties of the weights that I had chosen before, but in general it might not be true. So in general, these spectral parameters might play more of a role in the gauge transformations involved. So I should say that this method works in other situations too. It works, for example, for the elliptic quantum group, and that's one way of deriving that model I had before. Because unlike the stochastic six vertex model, unlike for the UQSL2 model, the dynamical R matrix for the elliptic quantum group is not automatically stochastic. And guessing a reasonable way to stochasticize it to make it stochastic is not so obvious. But using this procedure, it just spits out the stochastic values, and you can come across that model I described before.
How can you do this for the eight vertex model?
Oh yeah. So the R matrix associated with the eight vertex model, the one that satisfies the Young-Baxter equation, is the six vertex SOS model, right? It comes from the elliptic quantum group.
So if you take the rational limit, do we have arrow conservation?
Not in the eight vertex model itself, but if you want, if you want to solve the eight vertex model, then you do some. I mean, Baxter has this IRF transfer. I mean, this transformation that turns it into a dynamical to an elliptic six vertex model. And for that elliptic six vertex model, you can apply this procedure, right? Yeah.
In the dynamical setup.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So this procedure works in the dynamical setup as well. Yeah. So okay. Thanks a lot for your attention. Sorry for going a little over.
True, but I keep wanting to think that green vertex is an intertwiner between Jungian representations of the fundamental tensor Burma-Verma. Like the dotted line is just not there. Like,
sorry.
There's for certain values of the spectral parameter.
Yeah.
There's a map of Jungian representations or quantum group representations from fundamental tensor Burma-Verma.
Yeah.
And your green vertex looks a little like that. Because you're throwing away.
Mm-hmm. You're sort of dropping the fundamental in a certain sense.
You need the orbit, you're taking the highest weight component.
Yeah, and then
the fundamental in the output.
It's
not quite that, because I'll constrain S and Z to be very particular.
It's not like really like junction of Poisson lines, right? Because the dotted line, well, there's still a Poisson line, but in the vacuum.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it's quite what you said. I think I'm taking sort of an as. Yeah. We'll do.
Did you understand this procedure?
I don't quite see how this translates to Young-Baxter equation. Because the final, the right hand side, is you just have like single. R matrix, right, to the very right.
Which one?
The rightmost one.
The top.
Yeah, you just have basically.
You're saying I didn't change. I just moved this one through, and I didn't change anything over here.
Right. So that one you have S, and then there's this S weight here.
Yeah.
And then there's some line which carries this H, state H1.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Right. So. Physically, what kind of things?
I didn't explain why this satisfies the Young-Baxter equation. I was trying to tell you the dynamical rule you have to implement. But if you so each step of this thing will give you an S, right?
Right.
And this S is defined in this sort of way. Okay, and what will happen? So this S is kind of like this original weight, but gauged by some product of chi's. Okay, what will happen is that if I write down the Young-Baxter equation, all of these products of chi's will cancel.
Okay,
and they'll basically cancel, and they'll cancel and give the same values of chi on both sides. So if I write down the Young-Baxter equation with these weights, it'll reduce the Young-Baxter equation of the original model with all of these chi's canceled out, and that's kind of corresponding to the fact that. You can push this green arrow through the model. I can rearrange these lines to form the Young-Baxter equation, and I can pull it back through, and that will give me the Young-Baxter. That will give me the that will correspond to, I guess physically, I'm not sure of the easiest way to describe it. I mean, I sort of view it as the cancellation of these gauge factors. Although, yeah.
So in order to graphically prove the Young-Baxter equation for the S matrix, do you want to write down, introduce two chi lines in the Young-Baxter equation?
I will, to graphically, oh, okay. I never tried the graphical proof of it. Let me see. So what you would be having is, you'd be looking at, see the weight, the S weight of this model
right. Is
this divided by this, right? It's right, and the S weight of this one is this divided by this, and the S weight of this one is this divided by what happens when I move it through.
I see.
Right, so that's giving me S times S on this end. So everything, all the middle terms will cancel, and by the end of it, the weight of this times this by this is going to be this object times times so it's going to be this divided by this. If I want to compute the S weight of this Yang-Baxter triangle, it's going to be this one divided by this one. And likewise, if I want to compute the Yang-Baxter weight of the other guy, it's going to be this times this over the same guy. And then the quotient, you can easily, the Yang-Baxter equation for the original W weights implies that the numerator or denominator of the two guys are the same.
I see.
Yeah.
So weird thinking of this spin as the anemometer.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That was unusual to us too. We weren't expecting that. It doesn't evolve in the standard ways that the elements of the Cartan evolve according to you know in the elliptic quantum group. I mean the elements of the Cartan evolve much like the height function, right? It went from or maybe so this. But this guy evolves slightly differently. I should view it as sort of collecting the arrows as it crosses here. So here it's h, and here it might be h plus 1, which only differs from this by a sign. But the point is that if h is here, then it's going to be h here as well, because the sort of stochastic, this chi arrow will not collect anything when it crosses this dashed arrow, this dashed line. So it's not evolving plus 1 minus 1, it's evolving plus 1, 0, which only differs by an affine transformation, but it's still somewhat surprising. It sort of suggests, it makes me question whether, to what extent this is sort of representation theoretic, because this is not sort of.
Like G true instead of S2.
Huh?
It's G true instead of S2.
Sorry, it's which one?
It's G true.
Yeah, right? It might be, but I don't see the, where, why does this procedure have anything to do with the GL2, right? I mean,
if you wanted to go to higher rank groups, right?
Yeah.
What the spins in the verbal model, it seems strange. Why do they have anything to do with that?
Right. No, it's unusual, but yeah. I mean, the spins will give you if I pass to a higher rank model, then I'll have multiple dynamical parameters corresponding to how many what are the different what element? I mean, I view the higher rank models as sort of colored models where each arrow has a color depending on what basis vector you're in this object. So then the dynamical parameter will be a vector now that or an element. You can still view it as an element of the Cartan.
But it's a verbalization of a parabolic verb, I think, right?
Sorry, what?
The verbal modulus functions on C, which is a domain in CP1.
Yeah.
In higher rank, you should have a functions on a domain in CPN.
Correct.
It is a parabolic verb module.
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay.
It's not a flag.
Right, yeah. So then that, yeah.
Because those appear leaned out. We were studying things about Q operators, and exactly those kind of verbal modules appeared.
Oh, I see. Okay, interesting. Yeah.
Yes.
Is it more natural? Yeah, okay.
Sure. You can do this when you can apply this to dynamical R matrix, too, right?
Yeah.
In that case, do you get additional dynamical parameter?
Yeah, you have one dynamical parameter coming from the R matrix, from the dynamical R matrix, and then you'll have another dynamical parameter that is similar to this V or this K. Mm. So you have two dynamical parameters. You can even iterate this procedure to get more dynamic. Just start with this. I take these weights, this stochasticized weights, mm-hmm. and then I stochasticize them again. Mm-hmm. I will get another dynamical parameter, and I can iterate this process.
Is that a genuinely new R matrix, or just a gauge transformation of known?
Well, it's a dynamical gauge transformation. It's not like it's slightly unusual. I'm not sure. I mean, it's not a gauge transformation as I view it, in the sense that I mean, it's sort of a gauge transformation in the sense that the Yang-Baxter equation is well. For this gauge matrix, for this new matrix, is kind of similar, other than up to multiplicative factors from that of the original. But the gauge is not. Well, yeah, as I said, it's a dynamic gauge. I don't know how else better to say it. So.
Yeah.
similar to Vardic space correspondence.
Huh?
In a Vardic space correspondence, you like take the conjugation of R matrix with a matrix that depends on its dynamical.
Yeah. If I were to try to make an analogy, it would be most similar to that kind of transformation. Yeah.
Is there a statement like that for the transfer matrix of these models?
I don't know. You mean if there's a way to relate it to the vertex space correspondence?
Well, I mean, if I take the transfer matrix of the stochasticized model,
yeah,
and I relate that to the transfer matrix of the original model, is there some simple?
No, I don't know of a simple gauge that goes back and forth between them. So.
Can you just introduce that Kylie transfer matrix?
Multiply by.
Well, yeah, but then,
In the elliptic case,
yeah.
If I take it's like a generic elliptic curve, these might do something which ends up with real numbers, right?
Sorry.
So if I take a generic elliptic curve, I get all the entries of my O matrix are not real.
Right.
You do this stochasticization procedure, and do they become real?
Not necessarily.
Oh, so it's okay for you if they're complex.
Well, I, as a probabilist, I want my entries at the end of my weights at the end of the day to be positive.
But you don't get the.
I don't immediately get it from the stochasticization procedure, but oftentimes, I mean, there are plenty of points on elliptic curves that are positive. So, yeah.
So you need to find an elliptic curve of OR or something like that, right?
Huh? I don't need to do anything.
If you wanted to get real numbers in the end.
Well, I would just pick choices of the parameters, of the underlying parameters. Yeah, but I mean, yeah, right. So yeah, one way of doing that is to pick an elliptic curve over R, yeah.
Can you do this for arbitrary representation?
Sorry?
Well, this procedure.
Yeah.
Taking here A, I, and J, K to be in the...
Spin one half. Yeah, you can do it for other version or modules. Yeah, arbitrary spin. It works as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you can apply that to a T matrix as well. Right?
You might
just have to take the vertical line to be high spin.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So.